Zymex, and the reason it's here is these are all from the same kind of base material, but a different purpose. Zymex, not a digestive aid directly as far as food in the stomach, but the purpose for this when Lee released it was for the patient who'd been on long-term antibiotic care. No antibiotic is as specific as we would like for it to be. It's going to get close cousins. And so as it does, the antibiotic, that is, does its job, at least hopefully, it also tends to destroy the good and friendly flora in the lining of the gut. And so this was for that patient to quickly restore the normal flora relationships. Now, when Lee released it, the early literature addressed itself only to that. But what quickly happened, as was true of so many of his formularies, was serendipity, bonus, all kinds of other things being reported, which did not amaze him. I think, in fact, it scared him because he knew that we would start making wild claims, which he would say, I didn't say anything. I didn't do it. It doesn't do anything. It's just a food supplement. Get out of here. That was his constant battle with the Food and Drug Administration. We would see some marvelous result, and we'd say, Lee has a product that cures, and he'd be running for cover, saying, I never did, I never said it, won't say it, can't say it, get out of here. Don't even know who you are. In fact, I've never been to Wisconsin. That's the position that we often put him in historically. So there was this cat and mouse game that had to be played. He was very cautious about what he did and did not say. We're the ones that get goofy. Well, the reports that came back to him about Zymex were phenomenal systemic changes. It turned out that it had a broad systemic detoxifying effect. And he realized, of course, well, this happens because the body's ability to fully detox depends, first of all, on a normally functioning liver and kidney, but the liver won't dump into a toxic bowel as a protective measure since it is part of a system that is intelligently coordinated. And by establishing a better septic tank, the body was able to clean out. And so he began to recommend it for all very sick people. You could, in fact, as he said, all very sick people need super EFF. One could say all very sick people, that of course is a relative call on your part, need Zymex. Because all very sick people, without question, have a toxic bowel or liver situation. And Zymex, 6 per day, as a minimum in these cases, facilitates all of the detox mechanisms and works very well to bring about the thing we're trying to accomplish. And so, reflecting back yesterday to supporting the cytochrome P450 phase 2 liver detox enzyme system, you could add Zymex for its ability to also help the bowel get back to normal. It is specially cultured red beets, beet leaves, and wheat germ. It kind of combines the functions. It's not the formulae, but it is the functions of lactic acid yeast and cholecol 2. Now, we looked at them separately, and it kind of does that. They each do what they do more effectively, but it's a combination of those functions. It will help acidify an alkaline gut, and it will, like cholecol 2, help to detoxify. But it isn't a product that contains the volcanic ash, so it won't do that exactly the same way. So a variety of gastrointestinal symptoms. It does support kidney and liver detox. All diseases associated with toxemia and symptoms deriving from the same. And specific types of diarrhea. By that he meant not all diarrheas, because that can be from a variety of causes, but in particular post-antibiotic therapy-related diarrhea. Candida. Now, in many popular protocols, Zymex is the product of choice for Candida, but don't get the mistaken idea that Zymex kills Candida. The question would be, do we want to kill Candida? No, we don't. It's normally there. What we want is for Candida and all of the microorganisms to exist in their normal relationship. They operate symbiotically in the normal environment, each contributing to some function needed somewhere else. And so what Zymex does is restore the normal relationship. The Candida colony will resorb down to its normal size because it can't get all of the food supply. The others now are being fed properly. Everybody's in a happy, wondrous, cosmic, Berkeley-like gut community.
acidified for yeast infections. Body collagen diet, some of the other popular diets want to alkalize with dietary changes.
Right. Dr. Lee was a strong advocate of having an acidic gut, and many popular protocols want an alkaline gut. It's okay, it's America, they can be wrong. There are two schools of thought. There are many people on TV who are selling their wares saying a happy body is an alkaline body, and he can be wrong also. I just don't agree. I think that makes no biochemical sense at all. Now, one thing that we do know for sure, Candida loves carbohydrates. And high carbohydrate and especially highly refined carbohydrate foods leave an alkaline residue, not an acid residue. And so you have this link with Candida cases to things like hot fudge sundaes, Twinkies, and Hostess cupcakes. And in fact, the more Candida overgrowth occurs, the stronger the biochemical urge to eat those foods, which are the food supply for Candida. It's like an alien infestation. They're plotting to take over, rearrange the furniture, and change your apostat to make you want the things that feed them. Well, that's not too bizarre. Organisms that survive do that. They survive because they have the ability to alter their environment. So there are two schools of thought. I fully support what Lee's assertion has been, and my experience has been that when we acidify that gut, which is still a relative term, doesn't mean taking it to a pH of 1, but getting it from the alkaline side toward the acid side, that the body's ability to maintain this equilibrium is enhanced. It may well be true that if I alkalinize a gut, that may be lethal to one form, but at what price? What have I done to everything else? And what have I done to the body's ecology? So often these other approaches get a short-term effect and lose the big picture. Where does the body need to be all the time to maintain its own balance? And I think that's the issue there. Back here first.
Zymex wafers.
The Zymex wafer is basically the same thing in a chewable form. You can try that. It would take more, probably about 2 to 1. Getting it in the wafer form, it has to be diluted a bit. And if you like the sort of sweat sock aftertaste, that's just a good chew. But it is available in a wafer form. Zymex wafer? Yeah. Question. Same question. Yeah. Mark, do you have a dilution on that, the Zymex wafer versus the capsule? Yeah. These are questions we always think of every time somebody asks us, and then we always forget to find out. So then we keep saying, we'll find that out. And in October, you'll ask me, and I'll say, Mark, do we have anything on that? And he'll say, no, we'll have to find that out. So. Here's a good question. The question is, let me rephrase it. How does the pH of the gut relate to the pH of the saliva? Is there a relationship? Yes, there is, but here's the trick. Let's talk about pHs. Is pH useful information? Yeah, and no. It all depends. When I was in the Navy on submarines, we had a $20,000 pH checker because my job was radiation protection and corrosion control for primary coolant. And so I would check pH of fluids all the time. That's what I did. But really what I was into was like the macrobiotic diet, and I wanted to study, you know, the urine pH and so forth. And so I spent all of my time eating weird things and checking the pH of my urine. Petty Officer Dobbins, could I speak to you? We are not underway in a $2 billion machine for your private experimentation. I said, well, yeah, huh? So we did the Crimson Tide sort of thing, and he pulled out his gun and was going to shoot me, and I obeyed. No, I'm teasing. But it was Gene Hackman. He was the guy. Now, what I found was this. Based on what I ate, I could swing the pH of my urine from as low as 3 up to 8, and I could do that within a matter of hours. So what does that mean about a random pH of the urine sample? It means nothing. Zero. It's of zero value unless you know what the patient has been doing. So if you're going to do, see the point? It could be anywhere because it's a compensatory mechanism. The body's dumping to maintain its balance. It's useful knowing that. So for urine pH to be of any real value, I need to get it at a consistent point that tells me what the body's doing as a buffer system to maintain its own acid-base balance. So my recommendation is first thing in the morning, the first voiding. But then I have to know, what did you eat the night before? Getting it this morning, having had a regular meal, is very different from the next morning after two quarts of tequila just before going to bed. I'm going to get a different product. So yes, it's important, but only if I have a scale to judge it by. Now, saliva. How rapidly does the pH of saliva change? Well, it changes quickly in response to what's in my mouth, but the basic composition doesn't change as rapidly. So salivary pH can be a better, longer-term indicator, but there are at least five different schools of thought for what it should be and when it should be. What I would say is pick one that you're comfortable with that makes sense and do that. The greatest problem I see with all of us in the field is trying to ride nine horses at the same time. Can I have an amen to that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. How many techniques do we do anyway? Or, excuse me, how many are we the master of?
Yeah, right.
According to our business cards, 20 or 30. We can't just be good at everything. And so with these diagnostic systems, get one that you're comfortable with and do that. So pH of the saliva and the urine, important, but I don't fool with fecal pH. I just really don't care what it is.
Is the American diet or the junk food makes you more acidic, acidosis?
Well, here's the question. The American junk food diet, what does it really do with us? Here's the problem. There is an issue between what the food that you eat does initially in digestion and what it does ultimately. And the real question is, what is its final residue? And in many cases, a food that we eat that is acidic in initial content leaves an alkaline residue, as in the case of citrus fruits, that will ultimately alkalinize you. And many of the white trash foods ultimately alkalinize us. Now, everyone is different. It has to be burned to an ash residue to find out. But most Americans end up on the hyperalkaline side in the gut. And then the body has to compensate. And that sets us up for the pressing need for things like Zymex or Syro food or lactic acid yeast to get us, or Syro yeast or lactic acid yeast to get us back to an acidic gut.
Something then like an Atkins diet, does that leave the gut acidic?
Yeah, I'm a strong advocate of the Atkins diet. My gut could eat Sherman tanks. It will acidify, but it puts it in a range that the body can handle. Now, if I have a patient who is in trouble, then understand, as we alluded to yesterday, they're already in trouble. So dietary changes often get the blame for bringing out a pre-existing problem. And then people will say the diet did it. No, they were already in trouble, as in the case of gout. I have three studies I didn't have a chance to put up here. Do you know what three studies in the last year have clearly demonstrated as the number one cause of gout? Obesity. Obesity itself now clearly is the dominant mechanism, and everything else is a compensatory reaction. Hence, and it came out, only Atkins would even publish these studies. Nobody else wanted to talk about it because he always gets pinged on for having patients with gout be in a ketogenic diet, which I do nearly every week, someone, and we have a marvelous result. And his point was, no, the gout was already there, they're overweight. What they must do is quickly reduce the weight, and then the cause is removed. And so it's an interesting debate, but now those studies are out. All right, yes?
But I've got some patients that are very lean that have gout.
Oh yeah, they're just saying that statistically, that's the dominant cause. It's not the only cause. There are other defects in biochemistry, but statistically, with all the people that have gout, this is what they found. The eat right for your type?
Yeah.
I think you should eat right. Problem is, what's your type? Here's the problem. In that book, Eat Right for Your Type, the author of it, before it was even published, said that this principle worked about 50% of the time in his practice. Well, if you're a statistician, what does that mean? That means nothing. It means flip a coin. Well, that's not really. What he found was, for people for whom it works very well and can make a significant difference. But for many people, it does nothing, and I've also had many for whom they went backward. And I think the issue is this. the gene pool is just a little too mixed these days. It's not quite that clear, and we can get into the discussion of, well, no, it means certain acids and so forth. That's not the point. It's an arrow to have in your quiver, and that's how I view it. If what I'm normally doing is failing, well, then you pull out all of the stops for this patient, and the Eat Right for Your Type regimen will be another thing to pull out, and let's try this now. And if it fails, okay, but it's another thing to try. And sometimes that added on to the nutritional regimen we're doing is the answer. I do not find that it happens enough that that's a major part of what I do, but it's there. It's another arrow. I'll read everybody's book, and for some patient, that's going to be the key. So it's just another thing to consider. You had a question? Oh, here.
Yeah, so Jarvis doing the apple cider vinegar, he brought his patients more acidic.
Yeah.
And the calcium cleared out of the joints. And
yeah, again, the question is, when Jarvis did the apple cider vinegar, he was acidifying these patients. He was loudly proclaiming, you know, independent of Lee, Jarvis in his book, Vermont Folk Medicine, was saying sick people are alkaline. The pH of the urine is becoming increasingly alkaline, which means the body's buffer reserves are being lost, immune system is losing its ability to respond, and they're going to be in more and more serious trouble. And so simply apple cider vinegar was what he recommended. And Lee strongly promoted that. He told people who were taking CalAmmo, don't do this. He wasn't making money doing this, as Mark pointed out. He said, don't do this. But if you're not going to do that, you simply use the right foods, then I've got some pills for you to take. But don't buy them. Eat right. Well, I don't want to. Well, then buy some pills. Works for us. Kind of has something to do with the rent and things like that. Okay, there is a question, back to the previous, that taking the pancreatic enzymes will shut down the body's production. Well, let's think about that logically. If that were true, how many meals would we have had? We're back to the hydrochloric acid feedback. That can't logically be true, because we would never have been able to survive. Each meal would have caused a subsequent reduction in further production. So there isn't that kind of feedback. That just on the face of thinking about it. Now, if there is the potential for that to happen, it would be with those super mega concentrated products that are available. It would not be with what Lee had produced. He was never overloading, assaulting the body with anything. The only place where we have the potential in what Lee did with that is if we overdo it, like take 500 of these per day, or in the case of niacinamide B6 or B6 niacinamide, where they are synthetic in the natural food base. But then we've had the caution about not doing that, not for very long. So I see no problem with that, not with this. All right, one capsule three times per day. Now, that's not what I do, because the patients who need that typically are getting 6 to 9 Zymex per day. Because they're sick, there is a toxic bowel. For maintenance, one with each meal would be nice, but not therapeutically. So a minimum of 6, 2 per meal, and they can do this with meals. It needs to get in with the bolus of food and get in with the flora. We're not trying to do a specific biochemical thing, so when we take it is irrelevant. What I end up telling patients, they'll say, well, should I take these with meals or without? Most of the time, what I tell them is, get these things into your body today. Bottom line. If it's all at night, just before you go to bed, that is certainly not the best way, but better that than no way at all. So I usually try with meals, because compliance is better, except for those few cases where it must be before or after meals, like we talked about. But typically, just divide it up as many times as you will, take it with food, and get them in. Question?
We've been talking about digestive enzymes. Do food enzymes have a place in supplementation?
The question is, food enzymes or plant-derived enzymes, do they have a place? Well, what we're now looking back at is Howell's work. How many are familiar with Howell's work on enzymes, the key to health or longevity, whatever the title was? His concept, which makes sense, was this. He said that when we eat foods as we should eat them, then they usually contain the enzymes necessary to break them down themselves with a little extra support from us. And his philosophy or view was, we have a limited enzyme reserve. There is a certain maximum number of molecules of an enzyme nature that we can produce. And there's this final one where we just can't do anymore. Maybe that would be a genetic issue. And he felt that as we consume more and more cooked food and less of those foods in their raw state, we deplete our reserves, and it is that depletion long-term that sets us up for degenerative disease. That is a highly debatable point, but certainly has merit logically. So hence, Lee himself, being aware of that, fully aware of that, recommended consuming as much raw food as we could comfortably, not to overdo it and not to be only a raw food faddist, but to consume many of them in the raw state. He did not necessarily agree with Howell that there was a final limit for what we could produce, but that we would tax the liver long term if we continually consumed only cooked foods. Now, I refer you now to Pottinger's cats, the experiments of Pottinger's cats. So that's an interesting debate, and obviously, in the normal diet, we consume a lot of raw foods for much of the year. But there are other communities where, for large parts of the year, they can't, because what they have available must be cooked to be edible at all, and they survive nicely. So we have two sides of that issue.
Would steamed vegetables be equivalent to raw food?
The question is, would steamed vegetable be equivalent to raw food? No, but it's much closer than microwaving it for 4 hours. Much better than boiling. So steaming it lightly or frying it in a wok, Chinese way preserves at least 90% of what was there.